like everyone else here. Since the terrible events of last week, I've been reading and sometimes listening to Rabbonim, leaders of the community, trying to make sense out of what happened, trying to address the concerns of the community. How should we be reacting to such a terrible tragedy? By and large, what people are looking for, people are trying to offer, are words of comfort. The words of comfort generally focus on the achdus that this tragedy brought about, the fact that life is in a better world. And certainly words of comfort are important. We need words of comfort for the family. We need words of comfort for our children who are frightened. But for ourselves, I don't really believe that the first thing we should be looking for are words of comfort. I think that it's what's more pressing is to come to terms with what happened and what it means to us, and what it demands of us. You know, it's a mistake to think that Jews are immune from vice. You can go through the tshuva literature, and you can find in tshuva literature, you have there recorded many instances of Jewish crime. You could find theft, you could find adultery, look through the shuvas of the Leidah Yehuda, especially Rabbanim, who were in big towns. Even cases of murder. But you could scour the whole literature of Shilas and Shuvas and communal records and other resources of Jewish history. And I don't think you could find anything like the horror that was perpetrated last year. To find anything even close among Jews, a record of anything resembling such barbarism, we would have to go back 3,000 years to an episode in Sefer Shoftim, which we'll learn the end of Sefer Shoftim. We're going to skip to the end tonight. And that is the episode of Pilegesh Begimel. And I want to learn that, at least the beginning of the story, together with you. And I think it has it resonates very much with what we experienced last week. So let's begin this Perek Yutes. If you have a Shaitan, we'll learn it together. Says, in those days, there was no king at the time. Each lady Gorbi, I could say, Har Ephraim. He was a lady, and he lived in Har Ephraim. Har Ephraim, which is where Shiloh is, north of Yerushalayim. And he took a woman, a pilegesh, a concubine, from Beit Lechem Yehuda in the south. Now, the Perek says, by Yom HaMahim, in those days, it's not clear when exactly that the story happened. And the fact that the Novi situates it at the end of Sefer Shoftim, it would seem to indicate that it happened at the end of the period of the Shoftim. Nearly, and Rashi brings a Masoros from Chazal, that this story in fact happened at the very beginning of the period of Shoftim, in the time of Othniel ben Kenaz, who we learned about last week in Perek Aleph. And there are indications perhaps in the story itself that that's the case. First of all, later on in the story, we're not going to get so far, but the Pasuk mentions that they went to ask the Urim and Thummim, which was held by Pinchas ben Elazar HaKohen. Kala, but in Kabbalah, that Pinchas lived for a very long time, but in Pshuta Shul Mikra, the fact that Pinchas is mentioned would seem to be an indication that this is at the not that long after Klal Yisrael entered into Eretz Yisrael, time that it's still possible for Pinchas to have been alive, not 300 years later at the end of the period of the Shaitan. Chazal certainly had such a Messiah that this happened, this story, even though it's at the end of the book, happened really very early on in the period of the Shaitan. So why is it at the end of the book? If it happened in the time of Asil Beknaz, it should be Perek Beis. Last week we learned about Asil Beknaz. This should be the next Perek. And it would make sense why we're learning it tonight. This would be Perek Beis. Perek Gimel maybe, the previous Pesach Nichol maybe also is that. However, there is perhaps a thematic reason why this story is at the end. Because what's, after all, what are the themes of Sefer Shoftim? What are the great themes, the central themes of the Book of Shoftim? Is Klal Yisrael's failure to eradicate the Knanim as they were commanded. And therefore, what resulted from the fact that they were living the Karev HaKnani, as we learned last week. Perek Aleph described that failure. They didn't conquer the Knani, they left them, the Knani lived amongst them, they lived amongst the Knani. Well, one of the consequences was the fact that they began to slide into Avodah Zarah. And the bulk of the Sefer is about the backsliding into Avodah Zarah, which keeps repeating the cycle. They slide into Avodah Zarah, then they have Tzoras, they do Tshuva, then the Shaitan comes and saves them, and then they slide back into Avodah Zarah. That's really the bulk of the Sefer is given over to that. But at the end of the Sefer, we have this episode, the episode of the previous parak of Pesach Michal, which is a separate story, and the episode that we're going to learn now, which highlights what it really means to assimilate among the Knanim and to absorb the morality of the Knanim. What does it mean when Jews absorb Knanite culture? We have to understand, if the Torah commands in such harsh terms to extirpate the Knanim, the Knanim must have been an especially barbaric people. And we know from history as well, you know, the Knanim and Eretz Yisrael, I don't know that they left so much historical records, but we know that there was a Knanite empire later on in history that we know maybe a little bit more about. And that was, if anybody knows, it was an empire, Mediterranean empire, that was basically Knani. What? Phoenicians, but I'm thinking of Carthage. The Carthaginians, which are, you know, we know from famous in history, the Carthaginians were Knani. Carthage is Carta, the word Carta, a city, it's an Aramaic word, who was the famous Carthaginian general? Also know a little bit of history. Hannibal. Hannibal means Chon of Baal. They worshipped Baal. Baal was the Canaanite, was one of the Canaanite gods. They were basically Canaanite. And we know Carthaginians know a little bit about. We know, first of all, the Torah also tells us about the Canaanite, that they practiced infant sacrifice on a large scale. And the Romans were horrified by the fact that they sacrificed children. We know from archaeology, that they practiced infant sacrifice on an industrial scale. It wasn't just isolated incidents. They reveled in torture. Even the Romans, who were not the softies, were horrified by the joy that the Carthaginians took in torturing their enemies. The Canaan were a barbaric people. The worst of the Canaan were, of course, Stoim. The story of Stoim is going to resonate in the story that we're going to read now. And here at Klal Yisrael are living cheek by jowl amongst this barbaric people, amongst this barbaric and cruel culture. So what does that mean? It means Avodah Zarah, but what else does it mean? What does it mean when Jews start to behave like Knanim? And that comes here now at the end of the Sefer. Maybe chronologically it's at the beginning, but it's the capstone to the whole trajectory of Sefer Shoftim. It shows us at the end how, what it really means, how bad it is when Jews behave like Knanim. And then there's another theme in Sefer Shoftim, which really this pasuk itself begins with, and that is Ein Melech Yisrael, Yomu Mehenu Melech Ein Yisrael. And that pasuk, or a variation on that pasuk, repeats itself throughout these last few brokim. By Yomu Mehenu, the pasuk keeps saying Ein Melech Yisrael, Ish Kol HaYosher Ve'Enov Yaseh. There's no Melech, there's no government. And what happens when there's no government? So first of all, when there's no government, one of the main functions of government is to be a night watchman. To be safe to walk the streets. And what happens when there's no government, or when government abdicates that responsibility, and there is lawlessness? And that's one of the things we're going to learn about in the story. But government also has a moral role. Morality comes from the top. Government is supposed to provide a melech b'Yisrael. Any government of a moral people is supposed to provide moral leadership. And what happens when there is no government, when government abdicates that responsibility of leadership? What are the horrors that result from that? A little of that is going to be in the story over here. So the pasuk says, so this man he married, he took a pilegish. There's a question, what exactly is a pilegish? Focus on Rishonim, different readings of the Gemara. Does it mean a relationship with that's not marriage at all? There's no kiddushin at all, some say. What does it mean? Well, there is marriage, there is kiddushin, there's a marriage ceremony, but it's without the stability, the financial security of a ksuba. So it's a marriage, but it's a marriage that's very easily dissolved. One way or another, it's a relationship that is close enough to marriage that later on we'll read that the girl's father is called his father-in-law. So it's not, it is something like marriage. His father-in-law, the girl's father, the pasuk calls him his father-in-law. And later on in the next paragraph, the pasuk calls him the wife, the husband rather, the man over here in the story, the Ishmaeli, is called by the pasuk in the next paragraph, the husband of this filegish. So it's a semi-marital relationship. And the pasuk says, "Vatitna olo filegishoy." His filegish, she was mizanet. She went to her father's home, and she spent 4 months in her father's home. And here there's also machlokes, what does it mean that she was mizanet? Does it mean literally that she committed adultery? Or does it mean perhaps that they had a breakup? But Tizna might need to go astray. She left him. So they separated, but not that she was actually a mizanet in the normal sense of the word. There's opinions among the mefarshim. Might be suggested that maybe it depends on the two definitions of the word pilegish, because the next pasuk says that the husband went and he wanted to effect a reconciliation. He wanted to take her back. Well, if she had really committed adultery, then in Torah and Halacha he would not be allowed to take her back. It might be surprising that he would want to take her back. But if she's only a pilegish, if pilegish means that there wasn't really a marital bond at all, then there would be nothing wrong with his taking her back, and maybe nothing surprising about the fact that he might take her back. So we might suggest that if, according to those opinions, that Pilegish is really a wife, just without a suba, so that Tisna would have to mean that they just separated. According to those opinions that a Pilegish is just a kind of mistress, then maybe we can learn that Tisna means literally that she was Mizana. That could be. The truth is, I don't know that that necessarily is true. It could be that even if it was a marital relationship, you could still read Batizbola Pilakshoi to mean literally that she committed adultery. And I think it ties into one of the things we're going to see in the story. One of the things that we're going to see in this story is that there are no heroes in this story. Everyone is morally tainted. The people of Gibeah are going to be the extreme of depravity. But everybody in the story bears a moral taint. Everybody is affected by this living and absorbing the mores of the canon. And therefore the pasuk at the very beginning sets the tone that even this pilegish, who's the victim, she's going to be the victim, the innocent victim of this terrible story that we're going to be learning, but even she is not free of a moral thing. And so that's the very beginning of the story. That isn't all the pilegish. He went and followed her down to Beis Lechem, down from Ahari Ephraim in the north, all the way down through the land of Binyamin to Eretz Yehuda, down south to Beis Lechem. to coax her, to convince her to come back. When Aroni Moi took his servant, the Tzemek Hamayrim, and a pair of donkeys, Vatidiyehu Veso Viyoyim, she brought him into her father's home. Vayireu, and the Shver sees him, Vayirevi Anaro, Vayismachu Krosli, and he's very happy to see his son-in-law, see his son-in-law and his daughter trying to reconcile. Vayachazek Boichosloi Avi Anaro, and the father-in-law takes hold of him, Vayeshevi Tishleishes Yomim, and they're together for 3 days, Vayachlu, Vayishlu, they eat and they drink, Vayalino Shom, and they sleep those 3 nights. Vayimayom Ravi comes the 4th day, and the husband says, gets up early in the morning. He says it's time to make the trip back up the Har Ephraim. It's a whole day. It's a day journey. He gets up early in the morning to get an early start. The father-in-law says to him, first have some brunch, and then you can go. So they sat and they ate and they drank and the time passed. You know, stay another night. It's already well into the day. Stay another night. The man wanted to leave, but the father was persistent and they wound up staying a fortnight. Then on the 5th day, they get up early again. Same thing happens. The father-in-law says to Adno Lavofa, no, stay and have a meal. This Mamuad and Taisayoim, wait until it's further into the day. And so they sat and they ate again. Now he gets up again. It's already late into the day. The sun is starting past noon. The sun is starting to come down. Linu no. Stay another night. The day is ending. Lean poi, spend another night and enjoy it over here. You'll go tomorrow. The man says, no, enough is enough. And he sets out on his way. So why is the Pasuk telling us this whole story? Why is this important? The point is, he went to Beis Lechem, hooked up again with his Pilegesh. Now he sets out again. Why is the Novi so elaborate? So many chukim. Father wants them to stay. Each time he convinces them to stay, they stay another day. Then after a while, the husbands have enough, and they leave, even though the day is well, if they're well into the day. I think the point of this these chukim is that the Novi wants to highlight the horror of what's about to happen. Because they set out late, they're going to get caught. I'm sure many of you are familiar with the outlines of the story. They're going to get caught on the way. They're not going to make it all the way home. They're going to get caught in this town of Gibeah, and terrible things are going to happen to them. And this girl, this Pilegesh, she's going to die. The Novi wants to drive home the horror of it all. So the Novi describes the father-in-law, the girl's father. He can't bear to see her go. They don't email in those days. She's going to go off to Har Ephraim. He wants the daughter and the son-in-law, they should stay a little bit longer. It's hard for him to see them off. And so he keeps begging them to stay a little bit longer and to stay a little bit longer and maybe make another night of it and another night of it. And what winds up happening is that very fact, the father's being unable to set to let them go early, and is wanting them to stay, that causes them in the end to delay in their setting out, to set out in midday rather than early in the morning, as would have been more prudent. And therefore, in a way, the father is the one who is instrumental in dooming his daughter to the fate that awaits her in Gibeah. And this is the beginning of the Novi trying to shake us up and describing the terribleness of what's playing out of here. So the Pasuk says, Pasuk Yud, Le'olah Yishalun, Vayokam Ayelef, Vayavoy Adnefech Yibus Yerushalayim. So they're heading north from Beit Lechem, and they come up to what is today Yerushalayim, but at this time it's still Yebus, a non-Jewish city. And he has his donkeys and his pilegesh. Came in Yebus, and it's getting very late. And the servant says to him, you better let's go into Yebus. We'll find a place to sleep over there. We don't want to be caught out in the road in these lawless times when Melech came to Yisrael. We don't want to be caught out in the road at night. So let's go to Yebus. And the master says to him, "Lo yosurel inochri, ashaloi mibnei Yisrael ayna." I don't want to spend the night in a goyish city. It's too dangerous to spend the night in a goyish city. Hamish, I want to spend the night among fellow Jews, and therefore we have to go a little bit further. And of course, we recognize the irony over here. Afraid to spend the night in Yebus, he's looking for the safety, the safe harbor of a Jewish neighborhood, a Jewish town, and we'll see what happens. So we're going to add Gibbo. Let's go a little bit further. We'll go to Gibbo. Gibbo is a little bit north of Yerushalayim. It's probably where today is Shuafat. Those who know Yerushalayim, just north of Yerushalayim, of Yebus. Let's go either to Gibbo or to the town of Roma nearby. And the sun sets, and thereby the town of Gibbo, which was from the land of Binyamin. It was a small town. Later on in the war that results from this episode, Gibbo is able to field 700 soldiers. I figure every family could probably field a few able-bodied men, so it's a town of a few hundred families. So they come into town, and they come into the city, to the town square, and there is nobody willing to take them in. And they're left in the streets of the city, and nobody invites them in. In the ancient world, hospitality is the sign of civilization. Those who read these things, Odysseus, when he comes to a strange shore, keeps saying, is this a God-fearing people who know hospitality, or are they barbarians who don't know what hospitality is? Well, this is a town that doesn't know what hospitality is, and they're left to sleep in the street. And here we have also the beginning of an echo of an episode from much earlier on, Chumash. And of course that's the episode of the Malachim when they come to Sfayim. And nobody invites them in, and they're left stranded there a chayv ha'ir. The idea of course is that in Sfayim, which is the Knani, the worst of the Knanite cities was destroyed because it was so bad. And likewise in Gibbo, this Jewish town, but it's gone native in its behavior. A guest who came to town was not invited in. He was left in the streets because he had to pay for his stay in the city by being a hefker to the licentiousness and the passions of the people of the city. So they're left, they're out there in the cold. An old man came into town. This person was not a local, a native Gibbo person. He actually came from Har Ephraim. Everybody else there was from Binyamin, but he is not a native Gibbo person, although he's a resident in Gibbo. And being that he's not from Gibbo, perhaps he hasn't fully absorbed the Gibbo morality. Or perhaps it's just because he's a lance man with these people. He's also from Har Ephraim. And this lady is from Har Ephraim. And therefore his relationship is better. He sees the man in the street. He says, "Okay, no, honestly, where are you coming from? And where are you going?" And they say to him, "Let him Yehuda ad Yarkisei Har Ephraim, Yishom Anoki, We're going from Bislechem to Haraphaim, where I'm from. I went to visit Bislechem. And I'm going to stop by Shiloh, which is on the way to Haraphaim. But I live in Haraphaim, that's where I'm headed. Your hometown. Nobody wants to let me in. We won't be a burden on you. We have our own straw, we have our own fodder, we have our own supplies. We have lechem v'yayin yeshli and food. And for my wife, we have everything we need. All we need is a roof over our heads. The man says, don't worry, I'll provide all your needs. You don't have to dip into your own provisions. But for goodness sake, don't stay out here in the street. Out here in the street, not safe. So he takes them home. And he feeds their animals, and they wash their feet, and they're having a pleasant time of it. Maybe they're swapping stories about Haraphaim. It's again the language, almost word for word, the language is taken from the story of Stein. And it's clear that that's the point, that this is a Jewish town, and yet the language harks back, the story harks back to the story of Stein. But these are Jewish people, the people of the city, and Sheikh Leib Liyah, and the Sabu is the bias, and they surround the house, Mistapkim al Adelis, and they're banging on the door. And they say to the old man whose house it was, send out the man who you've taken in, give him to us so that we can commit sodomy with him, we can enjoy him for ourselves. The Ramban and Chumash, by the story of Stein, is so troubled by this episode. How could it be a Jewish town? It's mamish the behavior of Stein. And he tries to find differences. Not exactly the same, not quite as bad. Doesn't say there was every last person in the town. Stein says there was Minar Bazokin with the whole population. Here it just says Anshahir and Shebre Glial. It wasn't everybody. It was a town of a few hundred families, and it was a lot of people. Still a lot. He tries to mitigate it. The Abarbanel disagrees. And the Abarbanel says, looking for differences, you see the language of the Pasuk is at pains to draw the parallel. The Pasuk uses the exact same language that it uses by Stein. The Pasuk wants to drive home the point. Now, whatever minor differences there might be, but this is Stein. This is the Jewish version of Stein. And so the people of this town, Anshei Gibeon, they want the man, they want to raise. And the owner of the house goes out and he says, Alachai, al tereinu, please, don't do such a terrible thing. Achrei Yasher, Boha Yishazel, they see, he's under my roof. Al tasu esen abalaz, I'll make you a deal. In ABT, Absalom Pilat Sheu, I have a daughter, he has a Pilegesh. We'll send them out, rape them. Do with them whatever you want. But don't commit this unnatural act with him. They don't want to listen. And they want him. Well, maybe they want them both. So finally the man, seeing that he's in desperate straits, the husband of the Pilegesh, Vayachazeka ish b'filat shoy, he takes hold of this Pilegesh, Vayoytzi aleihem achutz, and he thrusts her out the door. Vayeduiso, and they raped her, Vayesalubo, and they butchered her, Kol ha'laylo an ha'boykert, the whole night through, Vayeshalchul v'aloysa shachar, and then at dawn they let her go. Are his actions defensible? Maybe we could argue. They would take them both anyway. Or this way it was only her, maybe one could defend his actions that way, or maybe if it was a choice between them, so his, with him it would have been an unnatural kind of rape. Maybe it's not as terrible, in fact a lesser of evils. Maybe one could defend his behavior. But then let's go to the next pasuk. That's possibly very strange. I said before, in this story, there are no heroes. There are villains. The people of Gibeah are clearly the villains. But heroes are hard to find. But the next pasuk says, such a terrible pasuk. The pasuk after this really. The woman comes towards morning. She collapses at the doorstep where her husband is. And the husband gets up the next morning. And he opens the door. And he's off. He opens the door. He's ready to leave town. And he finds his pilegesh with her hands touching the doorstep. How do we understand his actions? Some of them, of course, would say, doesn't mean that he had abandoned her. He thought he'll meet her at the gates of the city. Well, she had the night with them. He'll rendezvous by the gates of the city. I don't know, what did he think? She'll pick herself up, dust herself off, and they'll meet at the gates of the city. Others say that he thought she was dead. He assumed that she was dead. And maybe he didn't want her back anymore after this. Now she's so tainted, polluted. Whatever it is, it's not edifying. But anyway, he discovers that she's dead on the doorstep. But Yomer Lehi says to her, "Kumi v'nelcha, get up. We have to go." Ve'enoi nesh doesn't answer. Ve'itachel ha'amor, lays her on top of the donkey. She's dead. Ve'yokam Yisraelit from Kamei, he goes home, goes back to Har Ephraim. Ve'yavoyel beisoy, and he comes to his house. Ve'yikach es ha'macheles. And he takes a knife, a cleaver. Vayachzeik b'pilashoy, vayinatcheo la'tzemeo, and he chops her up. L'shnei mosoy nesachim into 12 pieces. Vayishalcheo b'chol gvul Yisrael, and he sends the pieces to the, each one piece to each of the shvat. Whatever his failings, I don't know, this is not a failing also, it's pretty bizarre. But what he wants to do, he wants to shake the people, the Jewish people, the rest of the Jewish people, he wants to shake them to the core. He wants them to feel how what happened to him and his pilegesh in Gibeah, how she was ripped apart. She probably died from internal hemorrhaging. So what's he going to send them? A newspaper account? That's not going to do it. The thing that will shake people the most, that will wake them up from their lethargy, will be the sight and the report of her dismembered body. This bloody symbol of the barbarism to which a Jewish city had descended. And everybody who heard it, who saw it, or heard of it, said, such a thing had never been seen, and never been heard of. From the time that we went out of Mitzrayim until today, consider it, utsu, we have to seek counsel, v'daberu, we have to speak up, and we have to act. The story continues. The rest of the story we're not going to read inside. I'll tell you outside. The rest of the story is that the Bnei Yisrael gathered together to destroy this town of Gibeon. And from all over Eretz Yisrael, from all of the Shodim, they come down to the land of Binyamin, and they say to the people of Binyamin, they demand of Binyamin that they should surrender the people of Gibeon to be killed. And the people of and the Shevet of Binyamin refuses, and they come to the defense of their kinsmen, the people of Gibeon. And the Bnei Yisrael go first to the Urim Betumim, to Pinchas ben Elazar HaKohen. And they ask of the Urim Betumim, should we wage war against our brother Binyamin? And the Urim Betumim answers, go and fight them. And so they go out to wage war against Binyamin. And in that first day, Binyamin wins. And the Bnei Yisrael, the other Shvatim, suffer terrible casualties. So they come back to the Urim Betumim. And they ask again, should we go again? Should we wage war against Binyamin again? The Urim Betumim says, yes, go out and fight Binyamin. And they go out and they fight Binyamin. And again they're defeated. So they come back to the Urim Betumim and they start to cry and they daven. And they say, what should we do? Do you want us to keep going? Do you want that we should keep throwing ourselves at Binyamin? And the Urim Betumim says, yes, go, and this time you'll be victorious. So they go again on the third day, they lay a trap for Binyamin, and in the end they, not only did they defeat the army of Binyamin, but then they go and they wipe out every man, woman, and child in Shevet Binyamin. And I think the idea is that they treat them like none. That's what the Torah says when it has to do to the Tanah, not to any other enemy. And here, the Gibeon, and by extension Bnei Binyamin, who come to their defense, the rest of the Shvatim feel that they've become Knani. They've gone Knani, and they treat them with that full fury that normally is reserved for the Tanah. And they wipe out Shevet Binyamin, except for 700 soldiers who managed to escape from Binyamin. And then they take a great oath that no one will marry their daughter off to a man of Binyamin. Then, a little bit later, they start to regret it. The whole Sheva is going to disappear. How can they allow a whole Sheva to disappear from Klal Yisrael? And they decide they have to do something to provide wives for these 700 last men of Binyamin. But they took this oath that nobody's going to marry into Binyamin. So they say, well, before we came to this war, before we came to this campaign, we made an oath that any town from all the rest of the Shvatim that doesn't come and participate is going to be destroyed. So they checked it out and they discovered there was one town, Yabesh Gilad, that didn't come to help in the campaign against Binyamin. So I guess that's a guilt by association. They're also guilty. So they go to Yabesh Gilad and they kill everybody in Yabesh Gilad, and they take the girls from Yabesh Gilad, the unmarried girls, and they make shidduchim, those girls, with the people of Binyamin. 400 shidduchim. But then there's 300 people left. 300 Binyamin people left unaccounted for. So they tell them, well, you know, in Shiloh they have every year at this time they have a festival and the girls go out in the vineyards and they dance. So why don't you Binyamin people, you hide in the bushes, and the girls come out, each one will go and grab the bride and take her home, and now we will have shidduchim for everybody. So that kachave, that's what they do. And that's the end of this very, very strange story. Never mind business with the wives for now. Why were Bnei Yisrael defeated twice? The Urim Betumim told them they should go and fight Binyamin. So this was the Ribbono Shel Olam mandate that this war is justified. So why they suffered to be defeated the first 2 days? And the obvious answer is, because everybody is tainted. The people of Gibeah, that's the extreme manifestation. Those are the people who have become so much like the Knanim that they're, you need a Ramban to distinguish them from the people who study. That's the extreme, the canary in the mine. But the entire people are being corrupted by the decadence around them. We saw it in the story itself. Even the victims, the husband, his behavior, to his callousness towards his wife. The Pilegesh herself, how the story began, by Tiznola Pilag Shoyt. And we don't need this parak. All of Sefer Shoyftim is the story about how Bnei Yisrael are corrupted little by little by the people around them. Tavod Zorah, Eslamichu was the parak just before. So nobody here is nobody here is. Nobody here is not corrupted to some degree. The people of Gibeah, that's the extreme of depravity. But it's not an event in isolation. It's a symptom of a general breakdown. And therefore, when Bnei Yisrael go out to fight Binyamin, and it's not preceded by introspection, to look into themselves and into their own hearts, so the Revelation said to them, to the Urim Tumim, the war is justified. The war has to be fought. But it's not going to be cost-free. Because you don't deserve that it should be cost-free. What you see in the people of Gibeah, you should look in the mirror, yeah, it's not as bad as Gibeah, but it's not what it should be either. And it's only after they take some kind of stock, and they cry, and they fast, and there's some kind of tshuva. Not perfect. This is the beginning of Sefer Shoftim. It's not perfect. But it was something, because we don't find another episode like this ever again. So there was some lesson that was learned. There was something that did result. You know, of course, the murderer of Levi Pesky was clearly a disturbed person. And the people of Gibeah, it's not the same. In Gibeah, they were not mentally ill. They were morally depraved. This was clearly a disturbed person. But even disturbed people, not even especially disturbed people, don't function in a vacuum. You know, there were disturbed people at the time of the Nei Yehud also. And we don't find stories about the little boys being kidnapped and cut into pieces. The fact is, unfortunately, that we live in a society that is awash in violence, and in the most vicious pornography. We're struck with horror at the accounts of what happened last week. And the images that it conjures up are unbearable to us. We shake when we think about it. But at this very moment, in America, children and adults and disturbed adults are playing video games that are almost as horrific, that allow them virtually to tie up and torture and murder simulated victims, and watching movies and videos that are even more horrific, which people are I don't even want to say, but with gory verisimilitude. It doesn't have an effect. It doesn't catalyze things. Last week was an extreme, and we hope and pray that we never have to ever again hear of such a horror. But that extreme is a symptom of a malaise. And we live at a time when Ein Melech b'Yisrael and Ein Melech by the Goyim, and government has abdicated moral leadership. Only a few weeks ago, we read in the papers that the Supreme Court threw out a law in California that forbade, the law forbade the sale of ultra-violent video games to children. Such kind of video games where you get to cut up your victim and dismember him. And the Supreme Court said that it's unconstitutional, it violates the First Amendment rights of children. We live in a culture that's toxic. And it's poisoning us. So what do we do? We live the care of the economy. You don't know, next door is silent. So we can try to insulate ourselves as much as possible, and that's important. I must say, that's important. But, you know, we expend a lot of energy in insulating ourselves. You know, we have been expending so much energy with very imperfect results. So I'm not saying we don't have to try. But that's not something, but it's not enough. We have to rethink about whether we belong here altogether. Maybe it's time to attack the beds. When aren't you strong? It's strong, you can still find wholesome environments. It has a serious thing to think of. I also think that we have to rethink the fact that there's a great moral debate in America. You know, we're not the only people who are disturbed about what's going on around us. And it's a mistake to think, and that was driven home to us last week, it's a mistake to think that we don't have a stake in that debate. The debate about the moral climate of America, of this society. The other week I sent out an email, it was a piece of legislation, I don't want to mix up the issues, but there was a piece of legislation that was going through the State Assembly that affected traditional morality. It was striking a blow at traditional morality. And I sent an email out urging people that we should call our assemblymen and make our voices heard. I got a lot of responses from people that I respect, saying, people emailed me back, saying, why are we involving ourselves in the Goyish issue, the issue of the outside world? We should stick to our parochial issues. The issues that affect us, I don't know, disasters, and they didn't give an example, whatever, I don't know, state supervision of pastorals. Why are we getting our, why are we sticking our noses in? Who's interested in what we have to say anyway? Why are we sticking our noses in debates about general morality in America as a whole? There's nothing parochial about morality. If we are going to live in Bekerev HaKnani, amidst Knan, in the midst of a society in which traditional morality has broken down, in which religious speech is anathema but pornography is protected, in which Ish Kol HaYoshev Ein Ov Yaseh, in which the moors of Knan and of Sodom, the culture of violence and depravity go unchecked, then how surprised should we be to wake up one morning and find a special delivery from Gibbon? So what happened last week was true. It was the work of one sick individual. It's a unique tragedy. But it's an American tragedy. It has all the elements straight out of a Hollywood horror movie. And it's the precipitate of a toxic culture. And it's a terrible reminder that we have a stake in the moral climate of this country. And it's not true that we're too small a minority to have an influence. Many people today, I think most people today, recognize that Orthodoxy is the voice of traditional Judaism. When Orthodox Jews speak, people recognize that that's the voice of the Jewish tradition. And the Jewish tradition in this country will get a hearing. In Christian society, the voice of Judaism will get a hearing if it's articulated clearly. Look at England, where they have a much smaller population, Jewish population, proportionally, than we have here. And the chief rabbi, the former chief rabbi, and the present chief rabbi have considerable influence. That when they speak, people listen. Because they speak with the voice, they speak in the name of Judaism, and people want to hear what Judaism has to say. And there are a lot of people in America who are alarmed by the turn that the culture is taking, and we should be speaking with a strong and clear voice about the illnesses and the malaises that are destroying our moral environment. These are not words of comfort. So when I was preparing the shiur, and I really didn't have to prepare it, I just sat and listened to it in my head. It really prepared itself. But the lines that echoed in my head were from a poem by Chesterton. Chesterton was famous in the Second World War. I tell you naught for your comfort, yea, naught for your desire, save that the sky grows darker yet and the sea rises higher. Words of comfort have their place, but they're not the most imperative words today. The most imperative words are the words that we read in the Novi at the end of the parak that we just read. V'hoyo kol haroyeh v'yomar. Anyone who saw, who heard about it, who read about it, said, Lo mirasov, v'lo mirasov kazois, l'miyoyim alois b'nei Yisrael me'eret Mitzrayim ad hayoyim hazeh, simu lochem oleho utsu v'daberu. There's never been such a deed seen or done from the day that Bnei Yisrael came up out of Mitzrayim until this day. Consider it well, take counsel, and speak up.
Thank you.